Tune it in, check it out, listen up, find out what it is all about.
Hello, this is Matthew Bronson, and this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson on KUPR 99.9 FM, originating from the high desert of Tlacitas, New Mexico. And today on Conversations, we're speaking with Joseph Sorrentino, currently a local playwright, amongst other things. And so welcome to the program, Joseph.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
If we had to give you a label, what would we say? Playwright or journalist?
I generally just most often go by writer because it covers a much broader genre, I guess.
Okay.
I've done playwriting. I'm considered to be a freelance investigative journalist.
But originally born and bred in Staten Island, New York.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you ever have that New York accent?
People tell me I still do.
Really?
Yeah, I've lived pretty much up and down the East Coast for years before coming out here. And I didn't realize what a New York accent was until I'd moved away from home. I left home for college at 18, and then...
How far away did you go?
Well, initially, not that far.
NYU?
Hempstead, New York.
Okay.
I ended up somehow in Tampa, Florida, to wrap up my undergraduate. And then I went home one time. I remember hearing my dad, and the accent just blew me away. I'd been in Florida for 3 years, and I was like, wow, that's a really strong New York accent.
You didn't like it?
It was, well, yeah, it was different, that's for sure.
When you hear, like, a comedy skits or whatever where people use that stereotype, are you personally offended, or?
It depends. You know, if they're doing it because they want somebody to sound like a thug or stupid, then yeah, it's a little bit offensive. I mean, I don't write letters or anything, but it doesn't
there,
really bother me.
Oh, it was a Cole Porter musical. When they're on the cruise ship, there's a young lady who has a very pronounced, like, Brooklyn type accent, and the character just wouldn't be complete, you know, without that.
Yeah, I think, and in my writing, as we'll talk later about the play, I think it's important to capture some of that accent without really forcing it, because then it's going to sound like you're trying to do an accent. My wife and I always, when we watch British series or TV shows.
Yeah, it's like, or?
Well, they always bring in a British actor to try to do an American accent, and they always tend to do it poorly.
How do you feel about was it Patrick Stewart, Captain Picard? He's British.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to blank on his name. I just saw a movie. Christian Bale.
Yes.
Oh, I mean, he's incredible. And he's British, and he does this American accent. It sounds perfect. There's no, there's nothing forced about it. Of course, he's probably had hours and hours and weeks of coaching.
Or the man who plays House, the doctor on TV,
mm-hmm.
Hugh Laurie.
Right, yeah.
Very strong British accent.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could do that all day long. I mean, I could sit here and pretend to speak with some kind of an accent, but I think if we needed to do something serious, you know, a conversation about a medical procedure or rescuing somebody, I don't know if I could keep that character straight as well as the accent.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult. I go to Mexico pretty frequently.
Mexico.
Mexico for projects, and all of my conversations are, the vast majority anyway, are in Spanish, and at the end of the day, I'm exhausted because I have to focus. I really have to concentrate. Whereas now, I mean, I'm sort of concentrating, but it comes naturally.
Right. But you are fluent in Spanish.
I'm proficient.
Proficient.
But if you were, I can't imagine it. Like you said, an actor doing an accent in a dramatic scene. So they've got to get the acting and the accent in sync. And
Plus where you're standing, your posture.
Which is why I don't do any acting.
You never. It's not like the musician who wants to be the performer.
No,
you know, you're the songwriter, not the performer.
I'm perfectly fine with telling people this is what I think it should be, and you know, good luck.
Have you tried to act?
I was dragged into a project when I was in Philadelphia. What's the name of the theater? It was a small theater in Philly. They actually were the first to produce one of my plays, Lewis's Lottery, and they wanted to do a project where they brought people together to develop characters, and they asked me to come in, and we did some improv, and they came up and they said they would like me to be in the play. And I said, there's absolutely no way I'm going to be in your play. If that's a problem, I just won't come to the improv anymore. I have enough stress in my life. I don't need to get on stage. Although, I mean, I give a lot of presentations and formal talks about the journalism work I do, and I'm fine with that.
But there's no shortage of examples of musicians who years, perhaps decades later, you know, songwriters who just started performing their stuff, or it's like, well, why should I write this song for you? Well, a lot of money, that's a good reason, and I want to write the song anyway. But then to go, you know, I kind of like the way I do it. Or actors. I don't know if there were as many actors or screenwriters, playwrights who became actors, but certainly most recently Sia, which probably no one, well, very few people have heard of, but she's a very popular songwriter, has written things for many, you know, top 10 chart Billboard singers, and just decided to start performing, and she's great.
You don't have to worry about me doing that.
Okay.
I know my limitations.
You might not think it's good, but they might. I don't, like most people, I don't care for my voice on the radio or on TV, but people say I have a radio voice. I don't hear it.
I do. I can hear it.
You might be a great actor, and
we'll never know. Yeah, well, that's okay with me. I know that, as I said, I've given dozens and dozens of talks, sure, and from everything from 20 people to 300, and it's not a problem, but there's something different about going on stage and becoming a character and having to remember the lines and the cues. And it's amazing. I mean, if you've ever been on stage, all of a sudden I don't know what to do with my hands. You know, they're just like, right, foreign things. How do I do that? And like I said, it, for me, that's,
but it's learned, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. I guess. But
so you for enough money or love of the art,
probably, well, should say love of the art. If I had enough money, I'd probably do it. But other than Jim, so far hasn't come up with any big bucks to get me on stage.
So kind of the what precipitated this conversation with Joseph Sorrentino is a play, The Gavones. The complete name is The Gavones of Philadelphia, subtext, an Italian family comedy that's being performed, a world premiere at the Adobe Theater right here in Albuquerque, and it's like 9813 4th Street Northwest, two blocks north of Alameda. It's a community theater. I would like to think that everyone in our KUPR listening audience has been there at least once. A year or so ago, I went down to take a look at it and talked to a couple of gentlemen. It's community theater. Right. It's exactly, and it's New Mexico community theater just by the structure of the building and everything. Mm-hmm. Now, as a, and you are, Jim Caddy is directing it, who should be known to many folks in the audience, and if not, Joseph said he's great.
Yeah.
How important is the director to you as the playwright?
Oh, it's really important. It's theater is definitely a really big collaboration. I mean, I write these characters and I hear them in my head, not exactly voices in my head, but
close enough.
Close enough. And so you create these things, but then the director, in conjunction with the actors, have to bring these characters to life. And watching Jim and other directors I've worked with, there are things that really don't enter my mind as a playwright what need to be done. And you don't know this until you start rehearsals. And Jim would come over to me and say, you know, we really need to get this character off stage because he's standing around not doing anything. Is it okay if we put this line in? And I'm like, yeah, sure, that'll work. So
I assume you know many playwrights, probably mm-hmm. many more than myself. Are there ones that'll go, just say the words on the page? I don't want anything different. Are there folks like that?
I'm one of them, pretty much. It's really,
well, I think you just said that Jim said, could we insert?
Oh, yeah. In that situation, it's fine. I had a situation in another town I won't mention in case they're not listening.
Well, everything's always good in Albuquerque and Las Vegas.
They said, I was actually directing one of my short plays, and they're comedies, and it's very important comedy. Its timing is very important. It's also very important for the other actors on stage. Their cue lines come from the person who's speaking ahead of them. And at one point, the actor was having a really hard time memorizing. He was paraphrasing things, and I finally said, you know, you've got to get it right. And he looked at me and he said, you mean you want me to say this word for word? And I said, well, it's not an option. That's the way it's done. I mean, professionals, I've told Jim from the beginning, if there's an issue where a line's not working, I'll tweak it. If it's not proper, you know, we'll cut it.
But who determines working when you do, or when the people that do it do like Othello? They go, you know, that line's not working. We need to punch it up a little bit. Well, that doesn't happen, does it?
I'm sorry?
That doesn't happen. No one wants to improve Shakespeare. Well, probably a lot of people want to improve it.
Well, they cut. Shakespeare's cut all the time. I mean, plays would run 4 hours or more. So they do a lot of cutting. Generally, what's generally accepted is if you need to, you can cut, but you can't change the line and you can't add. You can't decide, although people, I think, do in Shakespeare. You can't add your line. You can't add lines.
You may not want the full album side of Inagata Da Vida. You might want the radio mix for four minutes. Yeah. So you cut out some Shakespeare, but you don't change the words. No.
You're not supposed to, but I'm sure people do. They take advantage of it. And, you know, when I've got this series of short plays that are being performed, I've actually never seen anyone else do them, but you know, I don't know what they do to it. I'd like to see it sometime.
To talk to the person who has that kind of self-confidence to say, you know, Romeo and Juliet is too dated. It's going to be Skyler and Chad.
Well, I think they do. I mean, I think they update those things all the time. There was the one Richard III where they made it like a fascist.
Richard III?
Sorry.
Did they call him Rick III?
No, they just said it in a fascist. They used they didn't change the Shakespearean dialogue, but they changed the setting, and they do that a lot.
Right. How different is, other than the obvious, being a playwright and being a novelist?
Well, I think it's big. Somebody, my first play, Lewis's Lottery, I was interviewed. I don't know why people want to interview me for stuff, but it's okay. The person said, why do you write plays? I said, well, probably because I can't write short stories. I'm not good at description. Dialogue comes much more naturally to me. One of the scenes in part of one of the scenes in the Gavones, I was having I'm also a photographer. I was doing a photo shoot, and I was early, so the only place to get a cup of coffee was a McDonald's when I was in Philly.
Right.
So I went in there, I grabbed a cup of coffee, and these two men sitting across from me started this conversation that was just brilliant. And so I jotted it down, and it ended up in the Gavones. It was about senility, about what happens when someone goes senile.
It's almost like small little pieces of a stand-up comics act, you know, observational comics.
Mm-hmm.
That you have woven together into a story.
I think so, yeah.
So since it is dialogue, it's a story, is there a big leap going from a playwright to a writing an opera, at least the story of the opera, and then having someone else write the music? I mean, is there a Lennon and McCartney of opera?
I don't know. I'm not that familiar.
That would be interesting to find out.
We are going to Don Giovanni next week. My wife is taking us.
That's fun. Who's performing it?
I know Ruth Bader Ginsburg is going to be in the audience, supposedly. She's a big opera fan, happens to be in Santa Fe.
Okay, so it's probably the Santa Fe Opera.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to Albuquerque
mm-hmm.
Opera.
Yeah.
Or no, I don't Santa know Fe. If Las Cruces as an opera. Probably not.
I'm not sure.
So at some point before you ended up here in Albuquerque, you were still in New York. You were up in what city?
Well, I was born and raised in Staten Island, and I spent about a decade in Rochester, New York.
Well, which people have told me is generally not a destination for travel.
No.
It's not a great city.
No. No, but it's great because I met my wife there, so... I'll make sure she hears
But now that she's gone, there's no reason to go back to Rochester.
Right. No.
You were doing journalism in Rochester?
A little bit. I was writing for some local papers and magazines up there, and then I started getting involved with issues about farm workers So I started looking into what life was like, conditions were like for farm workers in upstate New York.
Is that a big demographic, farm
workers? Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a huge agricultural state. Upstate New York anyway.
And how do they deal with the itinerant workers? Does that still exist?
No, most people now are no longer called migrant workers because they don't migrate as in decades past up and right. down the East Coast or to California.
They don't follow crop to crop.
No, they tend to stay in the areas. They're more prone, at least in New York, to stay in the areas where they're working. There's enough work to keep them going all year round. Obviously, in winter, it slows down quite a bit.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do they do for the 10 months when you can't do anything else in Rochester?
Packing house. They'll work in packaging things and maybe fixing equipment. So they're much more settled population than they used to be.
A contributing part of the community.
Absolutely. The fact is, we would not be eating if it weren't for farm workers. There's just no way. I mean, I actually, the first time I worked in on a farm was when I was about 20 years old living in Florida. And I read this ad about picking oranges, harvesting oranges.
Okay.
And I called, and the man said, you can earn more in a day picking oranges than you can do anything else.
No way.
Oh, great. Let me go. So we get there, and you get a ladder, and you have to fill this huge...
You get your own ladder.
Right. Get your own ladder. And 90-plus degrees in Florida in the summer, and they ran out of water.
And 90-plus percent humidity.
They ran out of water midway through the day. And I fell out of the tree, somehow landed on my feet, which was incredible. And I went up to the supervisor and I said, you know, I'm not going to do anymore. And he said, well, you don't get paid unless you fill that crate.
Ooh.
So I did, and I don't remember.
It's
I just,
like Cool Hand Luke.
Yeah, I earned a very small
amount. Eat those hard-boiled eggs.
I earned a small amount of money, and I spent about half of it on liquids on the way home. And I just never went back.
So one day?
Yeah, and I said I would never do it again, although to hear in Hatch, I did pick chilies for a few hours. I was writing about the chileros, the people who pick chili,
right.
And wanted to know what it was like. So I picked for about 4 or 5 hours.
What'd that do to your back?
My back was fine. The rest of me was pretty... you're kneeling, you're in the mud, and your shoulders hurt because you carry this 20 pounds worth of chili on your shoulder.
If you don't fill the sack, you don't get paid. Now, do they get paid well?
No.
No, okay.
Nobody gets paid well in farm work.
Well, except in picking oranges in Florida. Or did that turn out not... Well, if you had filled it, would it have been good bucks?
I filled it. No, it was very poor. It was a very small amount. I don't remember. I don't remember what it was, but it was maybe minimum wage.
So your first play was Lewis's Lottery.
Right.
That's a good story.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
I was running a soup kitchen in West Philadelphia.
Let's start there. Why were you running a soup kitchen in West Philadelphia?
Well, I'll
or
tell
anywhere.
You, I had come down from, I actually spent 4 years in Albany, New York.
So you're just staying in all the highlights.
Yeah, I know wherever there's bad weather, except now, that's where I end up.
You got it eventually.
Yeah. So well, thanks
so
to my
you're,
wife.
You're down there.
I was in Albany, and this was in the late 70s, and... You know, I'd read about homelessness and poverty, but I'd never come face to face with it in Albany. And I moved to Philadelphia, and there were just people all over the place living on the streets. You saw them everywhere. So I started thinking, well, somebody should do something about this, and, you know, maybe I could. So I started volunteering in a soup kitchen, St. Mary's Church. It's located on the University of Pennsylvania grounds. And eventually, because, you know, there's a lot of turnover, I sort of ended up coordinating it. And I got to know people. And that's actually, this is how I got my start as a writer and photographer, because the people coming into the soup kitchen were very different from the people I was seeing in the media.
So you would think so?
Yeah. I mean, they were articulate. They weren't, you know, insane for the most part. And I started listening to them and writing down their stories. And I brought in a camera that somebody had given me and started taking some photos with permission, all portraits. And
do you have to get like a signed release?
No.
From a guy pushing a shopping cart?
No. I mean, I almost always ask permission. I don't like taking photographs of people.
Asking is one thing.
Yeah.
But I see all the time, you'll see even a news video of 15 seconds, and one guy's face is blurred out. It's like, did he go, I don't want to be in there?
It could be. I mean, everyone's afraid of lawsuits these days. But my understanding is if someone's out in public,
it's fair game.
That's on them. Yeah, and but if I'm going to do something more portraiture, or I really want to do a documentary piece, like down, I just got back from Mexico a couple of weeks ago and spent a week talking to street vendors, but I was going up almost all of them. There were two I photographed without asking because I thought, I'm going to get this shot. You know, it's really important. And it wasn't a compromising or embarrassing shot. So I would go up and engage people, and it gives you a very different photograph as well.
Yes. So how many people want a dollar or something?
Two out of about 30.
Wow.
And most out of that, the rest of the 28, I always offer 10 pesos, which is not even a buck.
How many pesos to the dollar now?
18.
18 pesos?
Yeah.
I think I went in 1980, and it was about 6,000 pesos when they devalued it.
I've got I think it's a 2,000 peso note that somebody gave me.
That's I had some dinners that were like 190,000 pesos. Like, I'm living high. All right, so you were you were serving up soup.
Oh yeah, in the soup kitchen. So and then it was right before Christmas one year, and there was a guy, his name was Lewis. He was a substance abuser and very nervous, a very thin man. And he came up to me as I was trying to get, I was on the street, and he came up and he's really excited. And he said, my number just came up in the lottery. He was a little bit strange. And I said, well, great, you know, I'm really happy for you, but
so you get to go on the mothership first.
And he kept, you know, no, my number came up. And I'm like, well, okay, great. So how much did you hit for? He said, a million bucks.
Really?
And I said, so it was my reaction.
You go,
really?
Could I see that, Lewis? And then run down the street.
So then, the story haunted me for years. And then I finally sat down and I wrote it up. And again, it was a very bad short story. But I, for some reason, read it out loud. And I thought, wow, this works as a monologue. So I developed it into a monologue. Its initial, and we did it as a monologue at a reading, where an actor just reads it. And somebody, a producer in Philly at a small theater said, if you flesh these characters out and make it a full length, I'll produce it. I said, okay.
You got it. We'll have it to you tomorrow.
It did all right, but it wasn't great, and I was never really happy with it, and I decided to turn it back into a one-man. And it took us 2 years. I worked with an actor named Frank X, who's just a phenomenal actor in Philly. And, for 2 years, nobody would touch us. They'd produce us. We played on top of in libraries, above a bar in Delaware. We got a couple of bookings at colleges, and finally Silver Eye, I think that was the name of the theater, took a shot and said, all right, because we shot a video and I would send it to theaters and people would say, you know, we're not interested, just put the video, put it in, just look at it for 5 minutes. If you don't like it, take it out, throw it away, I don't care. And they wouldn't, except this one small theater. And they said, you know, we want to do this play. And we got picked as one of the 10 best productions in Philadelphia that year.
Oh, my.
And the moral of the story is the next play I wrote, nobody would produce.
I thought once you got that first break that you kind of broke the ice. That
you would think, but it didn't. And then the Gavones was my reaction to writing Lewis's Lottery, because I didn't want to be pigeonholed as a social playwright.
Sure.
Somebody who takes on these projects.
Well, and did you follow Lewis? How's he doing?
I lost track of him.
You know, Facebook friends? Did it turn his life around?
No.
No.
Well, I can't tell you how the story. You have to wait until we do a production in Albuquerque.
But now the Gavones. Mm-hmm. Gavones of Philadelphia. What's the playbill synopsis of the plotline?
It's a story about those traditional Italian-American values of love, family, greed, and deceit.
That covers it all.
Pretty much.
Are they a loving family?
Well, it depends on your definition of love. I think there is, you know, Jim and I had several discussions about this, that from my perspective, growing up in an Italian-American household where everybody within three blocks was somehow, not everybody, but a lot of people were related to you.
Sure.
That there was always underlying, no matter how tense things got, there was always underlying love. And it was sort of, you could do or say anything you wanted about a family member, but if an outsider did it, everybody would be together.
Oh, yeah, that's a bad time.
Yeah.
So Italian-American family, And you grew up in that kind of community in Staten Island. In the time you've been out here in Albuquerque, have you found a good Italian deli?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It's Cucina.
Okay.
It's in the Montaño Plaza. They have a restaurant and a couple of doors down, a deli. That's pretty good.
It's all those unusual aged pieces of pork and stuff and like cappuccelli or...
Yeah, I've had the cheeses, which I really like. See, in Philadelphia, and we actually talk about this in the play, we keep talking about Claudio's cheese store.
Right.
And Claudio's is a real cheese store in Philly where they have 400 kinds of cheese.
I can't imagine. You can't even think of 100.
It was incredible. And I got to be really good friends with the owners, and they somehow were able to convince their clientele that I was Frank Stallone, that I was Sylvester Stallone's brother.
Really?
So because
I don't see it.
I don't see it either, but people believed it. I would have people come up on the street to shake my hand, ask for my autograph, introduce me to people. Mm. So it became this whole show, and they gave me a great discount on the cheese.
So, I guess so.
So I kept going.
Did you have an autograph picture on the wall from Frank?
No, but they, I don't know, people, and they were so excited. People would be so excited to stand next to somebody who they thought was almost a celebrity. But it was a lot of fun.
It is.
We had a lot of fun with
it. But don't you get any of that that show business from being a playwright? You know, they don't go, oh, you know, that's Joseph Sorrentino. He wrote this.
The only time it happened was we were doing Lewis's Lottery in Philly, and I was in a pizza store shop.
Right. A pizzeria. Italian? You don't know? Yeah. Okay.
And just happened to get up, and I walked by this booth, and this woman turns to me and she says, "Excuse me, are you Joseph Sorrentino?" And I said, "That depends."
Yeah, are you serving a summons?
How did you know my name? She said, "Well, I saw Lewis's Lottery. We usually gave we had a talk back after a lot of the performances."
Right.
And that was kind of weird. I didn't like it. I didn't like it.
Didn't like it at all.
No.
So when you are a well-established playwright in the theater community of Albuquerque, you're going to be a recluse. You don't want people to go, oh, there's Joe.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'll ever be a well-established playwright. We'll see what happens.
I have higher hopes for you than you do.
It was in Philly. I mean, it was pretty well-known in Philly, in the theater community and a little bit outside that. And it's kind of weird. Some people really want to be celebrities. I think that, I mean, we have these reality TV shows, and I don't know if it's still going on.
How many little boys got a guitar because they're going to be a rock star?
Yeah. But I never wanted that. A few years ago, there was people they were paying. There was a whole organization, I mean, for profit, where you would hire a photographer to follow you around, like paparazzi.
Right.
And I thought, so you're basically pretending to be a celebrity so people will think you were a celebrity.
And then what was the next step? What happened after they...
Nothing. I guess they got the photographs and felt famous for a day.
Wow.
Pretty weird.
That's very weird.
I like being behind the scenes. I mean, sometimes we'll give talkbacks and things like that. And again, in the journalism that I do, I'm always giving presentations. And I'm fine up on the stage in that situation, but when I get off stage, when somebody approaches me, and, you know, I mean, people will want to ask questions, whatever.
Sure.
It's always a little odd because you have to be aware of what you're saying and taking the persona that you are on stage.
You don't want to lose a fan, you know.
Right.
So for the Gavones of Philadelphia, now at the Dolby Theater, the world premiere, August 26th through 18th, a Jim Cady production. You've only been here for a few years. How did you all hook up?
Bugged him. I just kept bugging
him. How'd you know he was someone to bug?
I went to see when he directed All My Sons.
Yes.
At the Adobe, and it just blew me away. I mean, the direction, everything, there aren't many plays where everything works, where the acting, the writing, and the direction all just, and it just blew me away. And I went up and introduced myself, and I said, I've got these plays, you know, would you like to take a look at them? I think it took about 2 years to convince him.
But just to look at him? What else has he
done? No, actually, he read them, and then we had a series of meetings. I wanted him to direct another play.
Right.
And he liked it, but he didn't think it was something he wanted to direct. And it was basically, he said, what else do you have? So I said, well, I've got this Italian-American company. Send that to me. And he said, I really want to do this. I really want to do this play.
And why did that grab him?
Well, when somebody tells you they really want to do something, you don't go too deep.
Just say yes. Well, and not being a writer or an actor or whatever, I'll go see a movie because Tom Hanks is in it. Mm-hmm. Or if I like the basic plot, it can be no one that I know. I don't think I ever consider, oh, well, that's a Ron Howard movie. That's not exactly true, because I'm pretty sure he only does good movies. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I don't really pay attention to the director. Is that just my ignorance of the theater? Like in your case, how would... Can you give me a concrete example of what Jim did to a particular line or a scene that you went, wow, this guy's good?
Well, what he's doing, he's bringing it to life. The actors are bringing the characters to life, and Jim gives them a tremendous amount of leeway on that. It's not until... We're now in the third or fourth... third week of rehearsals, that he's giving a few hints on the character development. He's letting the actors find that themselves. But what he's doing is keeping the action going. I mean, right. He's got them... It's a combination of a sprint and a marathon, because there are some scenes in there that are just, they're nonstop. The actors have got to be in really good shape. So he's getting it, so it's nothing ever... There are definitely quiet moments in the play, and he's finding them, and the actors are finding them, and they're really important. But a lot of it, and it's not in what I'm writing. I don't do much with stage direction, because for the most part, directors are going to ignore it anyway.
Right.
So he's on his own there.
And in community theater, I would think mostly it would be true there. What I'm going to say, I speak English good, don't I? It's a general small cast of people. I don't know if they have 10, 20, 30 actors that will work the Adobe Theater, and that's who they draw from to do all the plays. You don't get people coming and going. Is that true?
I think Jim likes to work with... There are certain people he likes to work with, but they had open auditions. So there are definitely a few people in the play. He may have known them, but he never worked with them before.
Okay. But the actors probably worked with each other before.
No, not all of them.
Well, then there goes my whole theory. I was thinking community theater, it's this group of people. And, last week you were in the other play, you were my lover. Now you're my retarded stepsister. And since I know you as a human being, I guess that's why I don't act. And maybe that's where the director comes in, because of that familiarity between people that you say doesn't exist.
Yeah, I think it's good if you can have a group that you're comfortable with. And again, Jim, there were a few people, and I actually only knew... I only knew Mark. Mark plays Danny, who's an enforcer for the local bookie. And I'd seen Mark and
Jim. Is that like a Lou Grazzi kind of guy? From The Godfather, he was the guy that...
Yeah.
He was the muscle.
Yeah, he's the muscle.
He was more brawn than brains.
He's a little bit more low-key initially. But so I'd seen Mark, and I said, I think Mark would be perfect. And Jim had worked with Mark a lot, and he absolutely agreed. And the other... I know Jim worked with a couple of them, he told me, but some of them are brand new.
I know you're here via the Adobe Theater, but I'll ask you anyway. You've been involved with plays and community theaters around the world, around the country. Mm-hmm. How do you like having your play done at the Adobe Theater?
I think it's great. I was very impressed, and I am continue to be very impressed with the talent level. Excuse me.
How about just the venue, the way it's set up?
I think it's perfect, and I'd like to do some other plays there, if anybody's listening.
Let's hope somebody's listening.
It's a small, I guess intimate. I think Jim said it sits around 100.
Okay, that's good.
Which is good. And my kind of, I think, the writing that I do really wants a intimate space. And I think All My Sons may have been the first play we went to. And I thought, I really want to get my stuff
here.
And
if I recall, the ticket prices are really, I think, super reasonable. I think
15.
Yeah, $10 or $15.
Yeah, and then there's a Thursday night, maybe the third week, where it's pay what you want. And
that's community theater.
And it goes to the cast and crew.
Oh, perfect.
Which is nice.
Yes. So, is there always a big after party after the last night?
We'll find out.
Okay. What's next for Joseph Sorrentino?
Oh, in playwriting?
Anything in your life.
Well, I just completed a big project down in Mexico, 6 weeks writing, investigating what's going on with Central American migrants. It's very different from writing about an Italian American family in Philadelphia.
And not to minimize what you were doing, whatever, but hasn't like everything that could be said been said about that whole issue? Did you find out something new?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a hot topic.
It was a hot topic 2 years ago, and it's fallen off the radar.
Really? With all the immigration and everything?
There's not a whole lot. I mean, when's the last time you saw an article about Central American migration in the Albuquerque Journal?
Well, that's almost more of a commentary on the Albuquerque Journal.
And New York Times isn't caring very much. Once in a while, there was just a big announcement 3 days ago by the administration about some new programs they're setting up. Mm-hmm. So they ran an article about that.
Right. But is it dangerous going down there and doing Geraldo type of stuff? Or
it could be.
And why? I mean, being relatively fluent in Spanish helps, but if go down, small community, I don't know you. Why am I going to tell you anything that's going to be of any interest?
Because people in this situation, that was my 10th trip to Mexico, so I'm pretty familiar with conditions. And, you know, being careful, not coming off as a gringo who's going to solve the problem and I know everything, but going down asking questions and getting to know people. This trip, I stayed in two shelters, 5 days in each one. Previously, longer, 2 weeks, staying in the shelter so people would see me. In one shelter this trip, it was for youth. And a lot of these kids...
And they let you in?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I know the director. It was a small shelter. They were like...
Hey. I mean, you're not super old, but you don't look like a youth.
No. Well, I came in as a journalist. I didn't come in undercover.
Well, I was going to say that the people go... Why are you here? You don't look like you should be here.
It was tough. I mean, these guys, a lot of them were ex-gang members. Or somebody said there's no such thing as an ex-gang member.
Right. Well, there's a dead ex-gang.
If you try to leave, they kill you. So they were escaping the violence in Central America. And initially there was some friction. Nothing bad, just, you know, people were fronting.
Oh, sure.
And I didn't bother me. And I'd learned. And some kids, two days after I was there, these two kids just opened up because I bought them soda. I said, I'm going to the store. I'm going to buy a soda. Do you want a soda?
The equivalent of World War II. Here's a Hershey bar.
Like, yeah, okay. And then they sat down and we started talking and they said, you can't record us. You can't photograph us. So I'm writing furiously. And so I'm translating in my mind and I'm writing.
They're an ex-gang member from Central America and they're concerned about you recording it.
Yeah, because if somebody recognizes their voice or sees their photograph, they're going to get killed.
That's big time fear.
Yeah, and it happens. So I had to go into the office for a minute to talk to the director, Carlos, and I turn around and these two kids are bringing all my backpack, my tape recorder, all my notes, and they said, it's too much for you to write. You have to write too fast. You can record us.
Okay.
Which is incredible.
They were sensitive.
Yeah, and what I was told when I was leaving by one of the volunteers there, that the fact that I stayed in that place and it was rudimentary doesn't even begin to describe what the shelter was like. They said, you know, because you stayed there, they had a lot of respect for you.
Who pays to run the shelter?
It's part of a group. There's a very well-known activist in Mexico, Padre Alejandro Solalinde. He founded a shelter called the Hermanos en el Camino, Brothers in the Road.
Right.
And then this year, or end of last year, they started seeing a lot more kids coming up, escaping the violence, escaping the gangs. So they set up initially in Oaxaca, and now they're in Mexico City.
And do you know the source of his funding?
Donations.
Okay.
He's a priest.
He's not like
I'm not sure he gets anything from the Catholic Church. I know they get nothing from the Mexican government.
Right. He wasn't like from a rich family that he decided to do good.
As far as I know, no.
Okay. Well, it's always nice to know how it all happens. Rudimentary, basic, but essentially clean? No. How many inoculations did you have to take?
None. I always bring my wife's a nurse, and when I first went to rural Mexico in 2003, I had my clothing in a backpack and my cameras, and that was it. Oh, I had anti-malarial pills. I knew about malaria. But now she loads me up with...
How about anti-dysentery, a little Imodium, a lot of Imodium?
I bring that stuff. I've been really fortunate so far. And I bring...
You probably don't worry about deodorant.
No, it's not...
That's extra space.
No, taking a shower isn't always an option. And when you do, it's cold water for the most part.
I've lived in places where I didn't have water for 2 or 3 days, and cold water was just fine.
Yeah. Well, and this is the first time I went down in the summer. I usually go down in January and February. It was, and this was in Oaxaca and Chiapas, the southern, brutal.
Hot.
90 degrees, 93 degrees, 95% humidity, day after day.
High humidity down there.
Oh, yeah. Jeez.
So, what is your, why are you drawn to write about these people's plights? There's lots of sad stories, injustices in the world. Why them?
Well, a friend of mine, we've had this, he and I had this discussion for years. He thinks I do this because I want to do good. I really want to help people. And I said, if I wanted to do that, I would have been a lawyer or a social worker.
Right.
You know, and that wasn't something I was attracted to.
You assured
to.
Them you have no interest in helping people.
Yeah, I do things that, and they may help people, but that's not my, if I really thought, oh boy, if I do this, you know, if I write this play about a homeless man or I write this article about a farm worker, that's going to change people's mind. Things really get me mad. And the way people are treated on our farms, the way people are treated in shelters in Mexico, the way people are treated when they try to get into this country makes me mad. And people are lying about it. I know that they're lying about it.
Right.
About how things work. And I thought, well, I'm going to expose it. My job is to tell their stories.
Sure.
And expose injustices that I see. Not everyone's going to agree with me. I'm not advocating open borders or anything like that.
You're just providing information that hasn't been provided to us by other means.
Yeah, and I'd like the United States and Mexico to follow both our national and international laws. If they did that, then I'd be out of a job, and that would be fine.
Because this piece will live on the internet forever and ever, I'll mention this anyway. I read in an alternative news source that because of the migration between Nicaragua and Mexico, that they're in the process of building a wall down there to stop illegal migration. And that just tickled me as how weird is that?
They're never going to build a wall. I was at the river that separates Guatemala from Mexico is called the Rio Suchiate.
Right.
And the United States has poured tens and tens of maybe $100 million into securing Mexico's southern border, pouring money into equipment, pouring money into their immigration agency called INM, or the initials. And I went there twice.
Right.
And there's a port of entry, official port of entry here, and there's a couple of people straggling through there.
Right.
And I don't know, you know, a couple hundred feet away, hundreds of people are crossing the river. They call these things rafts.
Right.
And I was in contact with the UN High Commission on Refugees, and I went with them the first time to the river, and they said, you can cross into Guatemala on those rafts if you want. I took one look at those rafts, and I thought, no. What are you crazy? There are four huge inner tubes. I mean, huge inner tubes with just planks,
right,
on top of it.
How big is the river?
And they're going across. It's a, I don't know, 150 feet across, probably.
Okay.
And it's a raging river. I mean, they're.
Well, it's better than going from Cuba to Key West.
Yeah, but you tip over in one of those things.
And it's the current's too strong to swim.
It was because it's the rainy season.
Right.
And the dry season, people can literally walk across, maybe waist deep.
Sure.
But now it was deep, and the river was very strong.
Oh, interesting. We're spending lots and lots of money helping Mexico keep non-citizens out, yet everybody thinks it's weird that we want to do the same thing on our border. But so from your weeks and weeks and multiple trips down there, is there something that you've learned that is like, wow, we're going to go, I didn't know that?
Well, I mean, what I've learned is until we get a handle on how desperate people are, and they're called the Northern Triangle countries of Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, until we get a handle on how desperate people are to escape the violence there, and it's the violence is because of these two gangs called Mara Salvatrucha and Calle 18, although they have different nicknames for them, are just brutal. You have to pay renta, you have to pay extortion money to live in a neighborhood, to drive a bus, to drive a taxi, to have a business, and they're taking 50% or more of your income in renta, and if you don't pay, and I've asked literally a couple hundred people, what happens if you don't pay? And they just shrug their shoulders and say, they kill you.
That seems like a bad business plan, because eventually you have nobody to pay your rent.
I would think so, yeah. I mean, I've thought about that myself. Why not keep the rent low enough so people can afford to pay you and still keep the business going? But they're just brutal. They just...
Yeah, you need to be like a parasite in someone's body that... Okay, or like a lot of fish have them. Another fish will live, and it'll do good.
A symbiotic relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah, Salvador is the most violent country in the world with 140 murders per 100,000 people. In the U.S., which we consider a violent country,
yes,
it's 4.2 per 100,000.
That's a big difference.
Yeah.
So they're going to burn themselves out, aren't they?
No, they just keep forcibly recruiting people, you know, to get a handle on how desperate people are. I talked to several people who swam that river.
Yes.
Because they couldn't afford 20 pesos, which is like $1.30 to pay for the raft. One woman
which
was
pregnant. Which is what you give someone to take their picture.
Right. When one woman was pregnant and swam the river. Because they know if they go back, they're going to be killed. I actually got a text at 11 o'clock one night. I'd gotten back to Mexico City. I was climbing into bed. My phone starts buzzing. 18-year-old Honduran who was in the process of seeking asylum was snagged by Mexican immigration, sent back to Honduras, and within days he was murdered.
Wow. Any of this drug gang related? Or is it just extortion?
It seems to me, with the Maras, it's extortion. In Mexico, with the cartels, it's kidnapping, drug dealing, you name it, they do it.
It doesn't sound like there's a happy end to this story, Joseph.
No, which is why I write plays.
Okay. Which is why you are here, because your most recent... Is it your most recent play?
No. No, it's not.
But this is the most recently produced, The Gavones of Philadelphia, an Italian family comedy directed by Jim Caddy at our own Adobe Theater, starting August 26th through September 18th, $10 to $15 for a community theater.
Yep.
It's the thing to do. And I like getting behind it because I don't think we have a community theater in Placitas, so this is a good place to go.
Yeah.
Anything other than we've done a complete NSA report on your life here? Anything you'd like to add?
No, I just I think I'm really happy with the way rehearsals are going. Tonight will be my last attending rehearsal because, Jim and I talked about this initially. He really wanted me, and I really wanted to be at the initial rehearsals so we could have discussions about where the play was going. And I said, but, you know, I know at a certain point, I don't want to be there. You don't want me there. And the actors, it was really cute. They, I don't know if cute's the right word, interesting. I could see them periodically shooting me a glance during a scene to see if I had any reaction.
Is that normal to not have the writer there?
Well, yeah. For this, since it's the first time we've done it, it was important for me to be part of it. But as I said, my other plays, you know, people put them on and all over the country. They've been done. The short plays have been done in Europe. Somehow it got done in South Korea, which I thought...
In English?
I hope so. I'm like, how does this comedy translate?
Wow, I'd like to see that.
And I have no idea what they're doing to it, you know. But this was interesting, you know, as I said, as a collaboration. So tonight it'll be... I might go once more way down the road,
right.
But they're on their own. And I was thinking tonight of just hanging, just keep shaking my head during the scenes.
And you can get more information at adobetheater.org. But you're also helping to pay the rent being an investigative journalist.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a standard place we can see some of your writings?
Yeah, the magazine In These Times.
Okay, In These Times.
We've done 16 articles together.
They're also on the web?
Yeah, the articles, and I have a website, SorrentinoPhotography.com, because I'm also a photographer. And when I do the journalism, I do both, which is...
Photojournalism. Yeah. You don't do bar mitzvahs and weddings and quinceaneras.
Well, if somebody wants to hire me, I do it.
Okay. Well, fantastic. I have learned a lot, and you're a very interesting person. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
For Conversations with Matthew Bronson on KUPR 99.9 FM in beautiful Placitas, New Mexico, we just had a conversation with Joseph Sorrentino. His play, The Gavones of Philadelphia, is at the Adobe Theater August 26th through 18th. Sounds like things are going well, so check it out. So for Conversations, this is Matthew Bronson. Thank you, Joseph.
Thank you.